Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. 25 years ago, in early November 1994, a young Astoria man named Matthew Joseph Snyder was killed while surfing at the mouth of the Columbia River, where multitudes of waterborne vessels have foundered. Matthew was 24 when he suddenly died on November 5th that year. He was smart, irreverent, gifted, solid promise of luminous flowering. His death was a jeopardy to lucid, nimble-witted regeneration at the cusp of a millennium, which he did not cross among the living, somewhere up front where he belonged among the best and brightest, unavailable when most needed. In the short term, Matt's death appeared to be of little but local consequence. He was not wealthy or famous, though he might have been, probably never rich, but acclaimed for his genuine originality that exhibited no trace of arrogance or condensation. The long term might, however, be weakened by his too early death. Matt had good genes, necessary genes. Our species loses without his receding. He presumably would not have been a political titan, nor a media mogul, certainly not a corporate creature. More a Pied Piper whose infectious and uncensored vitality lifted spirits and eyebrows. Loyal, adventurous, and funny, off the wall, friends and family affirmed. He flirted with a woman who rebounded every quip, a publicly conducted and playful exchange of wit masking as romance. "He was the best verbal sex I ever had," she said. Matt's legacy for the future might be as a cultural embryo. He was most likely a vital link of bohemian reproduction and avant-garde evolution. His lineage traces back to Homer and Lao Tzu, inflamers of the spirit, orators of thought and memory, and he also resembled the early gods, the playful imps who were responsible for the fun and well-being that gives human folks courage to face the future, though it inevitably brings tragedy and death. Perhaps a million people died worldwide the day Matt fell off his surfboard. People of every age, color, creed, sex, and nationality murdered, as was a young black man across the Columbia River whose body was thrown off the Astoria Bridge a few days earlier than Matt's death. KIA in a war, or slaughtered in genocide, Rwanda that year. Executed, assassinated, liquidated, purged. Collided with or run down by cars, trucks, buses, or trains at crossroads and crossings. Drowned in sinking boats or swimming pools. Boiled in vats while at work, or fallen off a bridge or skyscraper under construction. Perhaps a plane crash similar to one that plowed up an Indiana cornfield and killed all aboard a few days before Matt was crushed by an ocean wave surging into a river. Or they died that day from disease, AIDS, new outbreaks of TB and plague, from starvation, heart attack, old age, drug ODs, alcohol, tobacco-induced lung cancer, abortions, or miscarriages might be counted among the day's mortality. Yet ominous to the very near future in this brand new millennium, more living human babies appeared the same day than dead Homo sapiens left to make room for them, ever less space to accommodate them every day. Millions more people mourned the dead of that day, a quarter of a century and a previous millennium ago. They mourned collectively as well as individually, thinking similar and sorrowing thoughts. In Astoria, Oregon, a small maritime city that has mourned the loss of its men and women to the ocean and Columbia River for two centuries, and the earlier displaced native peoples for perhaps many millennia, Matt's tragedy was intertwined with the deaths of five local persons whose fish boat sank in the Gulf of Alaska late in October that same year, 1994. The deaths of six teenagers in a traffic collision a few years earlier transfixed Clatsop County for months, and when two teenage girls were killed in an overturned car not long afterward, their combined funeral drew overflow crowds that lined both sides of the block outside an Astoria church. Death is life's price. Each day is a rebirth, but also a day closer to the crypt. The mortal spool runs out faster the less time remaining to unravel. everyone's corpse is sprawled somewhere on the timeline. Relatively soon on Earth's calendar, the USA and the contemporary world it continues to dominate despite its current despotic disarrangement will be as much an artifact as Paleolithic bones. Quote, a millennium down the pike, when the two world wars and the rise and fall of the Soviet Union have faded into an obscure historical limbo, with the fall of Troy, the Crusades, said Donald R. Morris, a historian. Time's impatient neurosis does not allow lingering except in memory and nostalgia. Memory of us will rapidly fade, and all that is major to our lives will recede, vaguely recalled nostalgically or angrily as it fogs into amnesia. Our successors will regard us with either patronizing contempt or disappointed resentment, if at all, as they hasten to their own oblivion and hoped for succession, until the species perishes like the dinosaurs and the dodo in the course of the unraveling sixth extinction that humanity has brought upon itself and all other life on planet Gaia. A small sense of history sweep might be the building of an addition to a house in Astoria that was built in the early 20th century that resembled a cartoon house, painted white with a sharply peaked red roof, backdrop for Donald Duck and Bugs Bunny during animation's golden years. Laughs were anxiously sought during the Great Depression and World War II. The rise and fall of civilizations might be measured against the hometown builders who erect the pillars of every society and are so honored for their trade that the only son of a popular deity is claimed to have been a carpenter. These builders of civilization, though rarely its architects, cluster every day on the top floor of the redesigned house beneath the open-air arch of their incomplete cathedral, hammering, sawing, and closing. Soon plasterers, electricians, plumbers, carpet layers replace the carpenters. And soon also the finished creation will be so obvious that its creators will soon be forgotten. But they can be seen sometimes in ancient reliefs or paintings and contemporarily in photographs, films, and soon to be holographically projected. Building, always building regardless of rises and falls of however many Jerichos, Babylons, Romes, or Astorias. In winter, which is again fast approaching, Earth seems as though it were Thanatos, a vast rotting organism of dead flesh, each handful of dirt a grave for something formerly living. Every footstep upon the ground trods upon a corpse, as William Cullen Bryant imagined in a famous poem early in the 19th century, Thanatopsis. Total and sudden obliteration might really be something to imagine. Nukes, AIDS, the plague again. Gaia's hysterectomy, an astronomical stench of 10-plus billion decomposing human corpses littering the planet, plus the festering remains of whatever might be left of the natural world not extinct at our hand earlier. Maggots last if organic life in any form does not rejuvenate in some other sometime. Might Homo sapiens flare at its last moment as dying stars, civilizations, and billions of terrestrial individuals, including Homo sapiens, seem to do at the ends of their lives, a brief and brilliant flowering of its ancient and vigorous youth, instant replay of bright morning before eternal black hole? We should probably readjust our thinking about many things, such as already being artifacts to billions born and about to be born until the 12th of never, and that is a very, very long time, according to Johnny Mathis, who famously sang such a song 6 decades ago when the nuclear age was in knickers, before the other possibilities of organic extinction became not only terrifyingly possible, but quite possibly terrifyingly close. In the long fight school of evolving a facile brain in coordination with muscular savagery, parochial explanations for human existence wormed through various flesh, blood, and brain possibilities that eventually led to philosophical and religious pieties and platitudes that continue to engross humanity. So back to the beginning. When our apish ancestors evolved quite far enough to articulately boast of themselves as Homo sapiens, literally a mutantly intelligent bipedal species that sprinted upright across every continent and island on planet Earth. The so-called dawn of history is actually an immense period of time when a particular species formed a mental portrait of itself through what must have been incredible obstacles to even make a grunt form a syllable. We are wrong to think of early civilizations and the people who built them as ancient, as dead and disappeared from any relevance. They are instead the fertile youth of our species, vigorous, imaginative, wildly avaricious, and unimaginably violent. We are whom they bequeathed us, an inseparable, though often frayed, thread of natural maturation. Instead of regarding our early ancestors as ancient, wrinkled grayheads, we ought to think of them as infants in the nursery of our history. We are the old ones. We are born much later in Earth's age than our predecessors, whose brilliant and inspired youth constructed our own negligent yet frantically apprehensive middle age that sometimes seems to feel like sugar melting down our collective faces. I suppose after a quarter century, it might seem therapeutic to put a positive spin on Matthew Snyder's sudden departure. He immediately became a part of our past, unable by only a few days to leave a mark on the future by voting in 1994's off-year election. I missed Matt at the millennium, but I will catch up to him before long. And that was about Matthew Snyder. A very close friend, quite some time ago. I wrote it, and I call it Auld Lang Syne. And this is more or less, or has been, a rewrite of what I read when Matt was killed 25 years ago on this program. I read on this program. And now, by Dr. Robert Brake from Ocean Park, Washington, Confronting Oppression, Lessons from History. A great and good man, Solon, born in 640 BC, warned that power can result in evil and that greed was its source and its strength. He wrote that, quote, men are driven on by greed to win wealth in unrighteous ways, and he who has the most wealth always covets twice as much, quote unquote. A cogent observation made almost 2,600 years ago. Observing that powerful men pull the city down, Solon remade Athens in accordance with the new spirit of the times and laid the foundation for the first democracy in the world. Masterful 5th century BC historian Thucydides reasoned that since the nature of the human mind does not change any more than the nature of the human body, circumstances swayed by human nature are bound to repeat themselves. History can repeat itself. His history of the Peloponnesian War is a treatise on war, its causes and effects. Thucydides caught sight of a universal truth. Knowledge of what brings about the ruinous actions of war can lead men away from error to right action. Fast forward to V for Vendetta, a 2005 dystopian political thriller film in which V, a masked anarchist freedom fighter, undermines the UK's neo-fascist regime through cunning, the martial arts, and lots of explosives. V systematically eliminates the neo-fascists while mobilizing the UK, the United Kingdom, Britain, population to resistance, claiming that ideas are bulletproof, quote-unquote. V asserts that authority, when first detecting chaos at its heels, will entertain the vilest schemes to save its orderly facade. It's clear to V that a handful of oppressors seized responsibility over citizens' lives, responsibility citizens should have accepted for themselves. The oppressors consequently took power, using words to coerce conformity, solicit submission, and foster cruelty, injustice, intolerance, and oppression. Who's to blame? V asks. If you're looking for the guilty, you need only look in the mirror. There were a myriad of problems which conspired to corrupt your reason and rob you of sense. And that was V. It's time for vendetta, a prolonged campaign against tyranny. In his introductory speech employing abundant alliterations, V argues that, quote, the only verdict is vengeance, a vendetta, held as a votive, not in vain, for the value and veracity of such shall, one day, vindicate the vigilant and the virtuous. And that's a quote. I highly recommend listeners to view V for Vendetta, or read the book by that title. Flash forward to Donald J. Trump, who exhibits almost every characteristic or behavior associated with tyrannical leaders. Bill Maher, host of Real Time with Bill Maher, provided his dictator checklist, quote-unquote, which includes 1, putting your name on buildings, 2, using Fox News as a propaganda tool, 3, conducting scary rallies that advocate hatred and violence, 4, appointing family members to staff, generating personal gain, 5, requesting military parades, 6, casting aspersions at minorities, caging immigrants, and banning Muslims, 7, lying constantly. According to the Washington Post, 13,435 as of October 14, 2019. Number 8, pathological behaviors. 9, love of other dictators. Vladimir Putin, Xi Jinping, Rodrigo Duterte, Recep Erdogan, and Abdel el-Sisi. 10, obstruction of justice, especially via the Department of Justice. 11, claims like, I alone can fix it. Clearly, Americans must come to their senses about Trump and focus on peaceful, persistent, passionate, well-organized resistance. Otherwise, we face the horrendous prospect of what Salone warned against 2,600 years ago, more greed and evil. Heed the Latin, veritas libera abit vos, the truth shall set you free. And that was Confronting Oppression, Lessons from History by Dr. Robert Brake from Ocean Park, Washington. That the man sounds a lot like Matthew Snyder might have oscillated into being had he crossed the millennial portal alive. And now, by Matt Gallagher for the New York Times, a very Trumpish Veterans Day. A half moon of garbage trucks rung the southern fringe of Madison Square Garden, barriers to keep the parade dignitaries and VIPs insulated from the throng. Loud men with bullhorns moved through the crowd, issuing orders for various veterans groups, while teenage cadets fidgeted in olive drab uniforms that fit their bodies like paper mache. The morning smacked of crisp autumn air and rich star-spangled pomp. And for a few seconds at least, I allowed myself to pretend this would be a normal Veterans Day in the city, a day of remembrance, a day of somber celebration, a day of unity. Then my eyes found the garbage trucks again. A microphone grumbled to life in the park across the street. Whatever this was going to be, it was going to be different. An older man wearing a camouflage hat with the words Navy Veteran on it looked across the street with me. I could feel him sizing me up. You booing, he asked, or cheering? It was the question most every vet was asking each other as we gathered for the parade. Whatever our era, whatever our war. To boo the Commander-in-Chief on this day in 2019 America would be an overtly political act, the kind of political act prohibited in uniform and still often frowned upon after it. Of course, so would cheering the Commander-in-Chief. These are treacherous times, and the only thing worse than picking a side is not. Not cheering, I said. I know that much. The older man just laughed. There's always a bit of spectacle to Veterans Day in New York. In the decades since I got out of the Army, I have marched in a couple and worked a couple of others for veterans nonprofit. Something about the day's ambiguous intent, the offspring of Armistice Day in the era of forever war, is a dark, twisted irony. And our nation's many proud battle triumphs and myths produce a strange blend of earnest patriotism every November. It's a day and place where conquerors, protesters, bona fides, and posers alike can come together and be together. In recent years, I've chosen to spend Veterans Day in quiet reflection, taking my young son to a museum or our family dog to the park. But the parade keeps a special place in my soul. The 2011 version did a lot to prove to my younger, more combustible self, recently returned from the Iraq War, that yes, American citizens did care about the wars being fought in their name. They just didn't know any better than I did what to do with all that care and pride and rage. That mattered to me. It still does. The 2019 parade didn't bring that same sense of renewal. Presidents usually go to the tomb of the unknowns at Arlington on Veterans Day, but not this year. This year, the president came to the parade and brought with him a very different kind of spectacle. Hundreds milled around the staging area near Madison Square Park, maybe waiting for the actual parade, maybe just here for this, another front in the nation's ongoing culture war. There was a man dressed as a World War I doughboy. There was another dressed as an African military dictator. Uncle Sam handed out restaurant coupons. The top floor of a nearby office building put up a simple homemade sign in its window, Impeach. The energy along the verges of the parade ceremony and park was sharp, even angry. Possible violence is something you can feel if you've been around a bit of it, and this had that in spades, even before a tall, bearded man approached anti-Trump protesters and screamed, "You're disgusting," into their faces over and over. A baby-faced policeman came over to separate the participants. I asked him how old he was on 9/11. He didn't like the question, but still gave me an answer. Young. The microphone in the park grumbled to be again, and the Marine band played, "Hail to the Chief," and the president was introduced. He began his speech. On a television replay I'd watch later, his speech was subdued and, for him, temperate. Beyond the sanctum of garbage trucks, though, the crowd grew more agitated. A chant of "Trump 2020 was met with a sing-song sarcastic "Bone Spurs." Bursts of USA followed. A veteran wearing a red MAGA hat yelled at a veteran wearing a "Vets Against Trump" shirt and accused him of being a fraud. He, in turn, called the man in the MAGA hat a mouth breather. This validated his veteran status in my mind. That's a military insult, through and through. A NATO flag was waved, and so was a Trump flag, and a couple of pimply-faced Trump kids asked a passerby what her Peshmerga shirt meant. She explained, and they nodded, seemingly impressed. "I disagree with what President Trump did to the Kurds," one said calmly in the maelstrom. Only splashes of the speech could reach our ears. The president's clear delight at retelling the death of the ISIS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi caused a stir in the crowd, then a series of groans and head shakes, then more USA chants. A man wearing a signboard and little else that said Jeffrey Epstein didn't kill himself wondered aloud when the speech would end. It was going on too long, he believed. And then, on the other side of the metal gates, a man in a wheelchair wearing a World War II hat rolled by, holding a miniature American flag. "I love America," he called to the crowd. Everyone cheered. The president's speech ended, a 21-gun salute echoed through the metal gray sky. The sense of possible violence dissipated, and a young man in a Trump-branded overalls took photographs with a middle-aged woman wearing a large Bernie Sanders necklace. Things began to feel more normal, weird in the way Veterans Day is supposed to be weird. 30 minutes later, as our group waited to enter the parade on 24th Street, I watched a man who said he was a Desert Storm veteran confront two women holding anti-Trump signs. He called them libtards and ungrateful. The women didn't back down. A man wearing a Vietnam veteran shirt stepped forward to intervene. "They're patriots," he said, "and I agree with them." The Desert Storm veteran looked at the other shirt. "Where's your honor?" he asked. "Honor is what brought me here today," the older man said. Then he held up his own anti-Trump sign. "Same," said the other man. Then they just kind of stared at each other for a few seconds before turning away. as we marched up Fifth Avenue, ciphers and proxies for a republic as divided as we are about our elected leader. I thought a lot about those men and about honor, too. I should have said something, I thought, to bring them together. It was Veterans Day, after all. What that thing was to say, though, I still don't know. And that was A Very Trumpish Veterans Day by Matt Gallagher, who is the author of a forthcoming novel, Empire City, and he's a veteran of the Iraq War. And this is Michael McCusker.